Hey, oh.
Choke Point.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage.
Let's go.
Here it is, everybody. Would you be okay with your car's manufacturer tracking your mileage so the state can charge you for every mile you drive? Don't raise your hands all at once. It's one of the ideas being considered as the state struggles to begin a road usage charge system. So, Chris, this is actually going to happen, huh?
Well, they think so. I mean, the Washington State Transportation Commission is going to be pushing the legislature again, and I'll handicap that coming up towards the end of this report. But, I mean, they've been working on this for 10 years, pilot projects moving along. But right now what's happening is the industry and the playing field is kind of changing a little bit. And, of course, one of the biggest concerns in all of this has always been with this road usage charges, how would you collect the data? That's why during the pilot project, they had it from as simple as you check your odometer all the way to sticking a GPS device into your car and downloading the information. And then, then the question became, oh my gosh, how much privacy do we want to give up? Because that's going to tell us where everywhere that we've been in our car. And so as technology changes, the commission is actually exploring something called telematics, which is where your car actually sends the data to the manufacturer automatically, and then the automaker sends it directly to the state. There'd be no GPS tracker in your car to download. The car would just be talking to the state and sending out all sorts of information, way more information than you could possibly
imagine. But it amounts to a GPS tracker.
It does, but it's your car sending it to the manufacturer.
Right.
The manufacturer then now has all this data that it can mine, and then you send it to the state, which says it's only going to mine a certain amount. And so that's, you know, the things that they could find in that now are where you go, where you eat, what times of day you like to travel, plus all your travel habits. Like, do you like to speed? Do you hit the brakes a lot? And so that's the newest kind of component to this. Travis Dunn is an engineer with the construction firm CD Smith. He did this analysis for the commission, and he updated the commission on how that would work.
New vehicles are all equipped with certainly the data are collected on board, but now they're also equipped with the ability to transmit that data. So accessing it directly from the automakers is a way to, in the long term, reduce costs and also improve the user experience.
Now, to make sure that he heard that correctly, commission member Jim Rastucci asked for a clarification.
You're talking about not plugging a device into the onboard diagnostic port and actually using the car itself to communicate the telematics details, correct?
Correct.
Now, this is just something that the commission is looking at. They have not decided, or the legislature would eventually have to decide, how you would track this information. But the bottom line is they are going to be moving to a road usage charge at some point because of a variety of different issues. And I'm going to go to one right now, is that the speed with which automakers are now committing to electrifying fleets and the cars and what we've talked about, the plants being built and things like that, because we know EVs don't pay for the roads with the gas tax because they don't use gas, right? And so the commission is concerned that that's why they want to get this ruck going up and quickly, because they want to capture those dollars for the roads and the transportation projects as more EVs get on the road.
We've been at this for 10 years, and the world has been shifting at unprecedented pace in terms of a transition and the motivation of the automakers. And I mean, there's just so much happening every year. It accelerates. I'm just wondering, Travis, if we need to refresh our timeline.
That's Commission Executive Director Rima Griffith. The commission is finalizing its pitch to the legislature, which it will deliver next month. They're tasked with putting that together here over the next 2 weeks. It will once again be asking for lawmakers to at least start the RUC program, even on a limited basis, just to get the ball rolling.
Everything's indicating the nation is gearing up, and we need to kind of pick up our pace as well.
And of course, there's obviously going to be a long transition between gas and this whole thing, and they'd figure out how to do all that. But it's not just the transition or the amount of EVs or the privacy. Dunn's research actually said that lower income people will suffer more than others the longer that the gas tax is in use. People, for example, making under $30,000 a year pay up to 40% of their income on transportation. Now, only 4% of that would be the road usage charge or gas tax, but most of that is, you know, the lower income you make, you have a car, the car is a bigger expense of your overall. And so with those lower income folks most likely driving older and less fuel efficient cars, they would pay more per mile in taxes. If the state switches to pay by mile, everybody pays the same.
What this means is that if you were to imagine hypothetically switching to a road usage charge across the board for all vehicles, the payments would be equalized. It would be $240 across the board. So the lower income households would save, and the higher income households would pay more.
And that $240 that he's representing there is 2.4 cents, which would be the road mile charge over an average 10,000 miles driven a year.
That's the price they're considering?
Yeah, 2.4 cents per mile. Because they want to try to make it about as neutral to the actual gas tax per mile right now, and that's the number that they've been
working
out.
So in other words,
out.
This would not collect additional revenue. This is a way to collect the same amount
the
of revenue,
same amount,
but do
capture,
it more fairly.
Yeah, but do it more for make it. So Dave, you and your Prius would pay more. Me in my, you know, I'd pay the same probably, even though my car is probably less fuel efficient here, so I'd pay, you know, pay a little more. But yeah, the whole idea is to equalize this so they capture the money they're not getting now as the types of cars change, and also to equalize it for folks with lower incomes who end up, you know, with maybe an older car that doesn't get the bang for the buck at the gas pump. And so, yeah. So now the question is this going to pass? Because again, it's up to the legislature, and we've been working on this for 10 years. We got a short session coming up. Not sure if it happens in 22. Rima Griffith there, the executive director, is, you know, cross her fingers, but she's like, I don't know if we can get this done in a short session, but they're going to be pushing hard to try to at least get this started in some way so the transition can begin.
Now, what do they do about older cars? Because those cars don't have the necessary chips to pay the are we going to get the RUC now?
Yeah, well, that's what they call it. The RUC is just easy. I mean, pay by mile, RUC, road usage charge. RUC is just easier than.
So what about the older cars then?
Yeah, that's one of the other things they're trying to figure out how they make that happen, you know, because you might have to pay the gas tax, and then, you know, you might just have to look at the odometer. There are going to be multiple ways in which they're going to have to try to capture this, but that is a big issue. And also, one of the issues also now for even the newer cars is there's a chip shortage for those things that track all of our mileage and everything, too. So, yeah, there, as I said, there's so much up in the air on this that has to be figured out, but the commission wants to at least start working because everything else around nationally is changing.
So is any other state this far along on a road?
Oh, further. Oregon's further down the line. They've actually had a program actually going.
Really?
On a very limited basis.
I mean, not just a pilot program?
I mean, it's a pilot for a limited amount. I mean, they did a pilot, and now they've actually started this process in a limited way. And they also believe the commission here in Washington, they'd maybe start this with you, Dave. The electric vehicle folks would get the honor of starting with this, limited as well, to kind of see how it goes.
Let's see. My Prius is 6-7 years old now. I don't think it has the magic chip in it.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, you need a booster chip. It's been 6 years, Dave. You're due. So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's when we first started talking about this 10 years ago, there was a whole list of questions. Now the industry has kind of changed. EVs are coming more on board. And then we have the, you know, the questions of, you know, bringing prices down for EVs. And then we have now this different way to collect data.
Well,
it's a whole different set of issues.
Once everything goes electric, the gas tax, obviously, no longer works.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, there's a lot up in the air. It's interesting, but I do like the fact that this is a more stable way to, and a probably a more equitable way for everybody to pay for the roads to help fix them.
Plus, you'd be paying for your local roads as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. 6:37, Seattle's Morning News. Washington became the first state to legalize pot 9 years ago, December 6, 2012. It started a whole new industry, but an industry that remains handicapped by rules that don't apply to any other business, and they're tired of it. Chi Radio's Hannah Scott is here with the industry's legislative wish list for the next session. Morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Just a couple of big items on this, along with several smaller technical issues that they want to change. But the legal marijuana business has generated a lot of much-needed revenue for the state over the past 9 years. And now
2022 is going to be the 10-year anniversary of the passage of Initiative 502. It's in some ways feels like a lifetime, in other ways feels like it was just yesterday. And so we are really trying to look at this from that lens in terms of what do the next 10 years look like for the industry in Washington State, and how do we set ourselves up and the entrepreneurs and risk takers that got into the industry here, how do we set them up for success for the next 10 years, which likely includes some form of federal legalization and a federal marketplace, in fact, even a global marketplace? You know, what are the barriers that are keeping our companies from being able to succeed?
That's Vicki Christofferson with the Wa Cannabis Business Association. She's the director, and she says topping the list.
We are still the only one of two states in the entire country that don't allow investment dollars to flow into the industry from out of state. And that may seem daunting to some people, like somehow allowing that would allow big, you know, I don't know, big tobacco or whoever to come into the industry. But the reality is venture capital is a key, really, to launching a business.
And that's especially true with the marijuana industry.
We have to have a location and all the security that's required and all of that. And then you have to secure inventory and you have to hire staff. And all of those things have to happen really before you can even open up. And so what we see is people really struggling to access capital. If you don't have money yourself, or you don't have a rich relative that lives here in Washington, you're out of luck.
And then that, of course, gets into the issue of equity in the cannabis industry, which is also a big priority. But this also has an impact on the buyers, she said.
We see this for brands on the processor side, you know, brands that are really establishing themselves as things that customers really like, whether those are the products that help with headaches or some health issues, but also products that are innovative and different, where you need that next $1 million to expand your brand. We really believe that it is something that the state needs to look at about how to safely allow capital to flow as it does with every other business.
Because the other part of that is that if there's something that's really popular amongst the buyers that the state cannot provide, where do they go to get it? Those on the black market who can also provide it. So that's the big reason they're going to ask for the legislature to change that. The other big issue is about the industry's board. So back when this passed, 502, the makeup of the liquor control board or and cannabis board that is now has always been just the three people who make all the decisions. At that same time, and I don't know if you remember this, Dave, they also passed a law that is under the LCB where we privatized liquor sales, right? Because it used to be in the state stores. So that put all this work on the LCB, and they think it's too much. They want to expand that board. There's been some issues where there's a lot of focus on enforcement, and that's really not the general idea behind the cannabis industry. And so they want to make it more like the State Gaming Commission with more people to share that workload.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross, and joining me now is Hannah Scott and the outgoing mayor of Seattle, Jenny Durkin. And Mayor Durkin, you may not know this, but as part of the city charter, no mayor gets to leave office unless Hannah does the exit interview first. And so here she is to do that, and I'll just turn it over to you, Hannah. Go ahead.
All right. Mayor, what do you think your biggest accomplishments have been?
I am wholly supportive of amending the city charter to require an exit interview. So I think it's two things. One is really the overarching challenge of my administration. And then it's how did we move forward as a city to really address equity and some of the challenges I had coming in. So on the first, obviously, my term as mayor has been defined by COVID. And I think our whole city, region, and country in the last 2 years has been defined by this global pandemic. And when that hit us early in 2020, we as a city were the first in the area, the first into the pandemic. We had no guidebook. We had very little support from the federal government, sometimes working against us. And we had to find our own way forward. And I think that two things really stand out. First is what we were able to do during the pandemic to address the huge challenges we faced. And the second was how we did it. The how we did it was we came together as a city, as a region, public health officials, hospital systems, business, and community members. And everybody recognized the common challenge, rolled up our sleeves, and figured out how did we move forward together. I think that has to be the model for our city and the incoming mayor on the biggest challenges facing us, because that is the only way that I think you can address the problems and issues and challenges at scope. The second is what we did. And really, if you look kind of at the trajectory of the pandemic from the earliest days, you know, on the first day when I learned that we had COVID here in the region, that day started very normally for a mayor. And that afternoon, former Chief Betts and I were leading a parade of Girl Scouts downtown to introduce the new Girl Scout lemon cookie. I went home. You know, think about that.
Yeah.
Two hours later, I got the call and we moved forward. But every step of the way, our city and our region stepped up. I'm really proud of the leadership that I and the city provided in testing and in vaccinations. And we were the first city in America to reach 70% vaccinations. And today, despite the fact we were the first facing this challenge, we have the lowest incidence of COVID, lowest incidence of hospitalizations, and lowest mortality rate. Doesn't mean a lot of people haven't suffered, and it's been so hard for everyone. But we got through that with that kind of accomplishments because of what we did together as a city. The other accomplishment I just want to thank the people of Seattle for is the Seattle Promise Program. I am so proud and think it will be one of the things that really changes the trajectory of our city and really embeds equity. When I came in, there was one pilot program that had about 100 students in it. We extended that to every Seattle public school student and every one of our public high school students and all the Seattle colleges. This year, more than 1,000 enrolled, and we've had 2,300 participate.
Now, you mentioned equity a couple of times, Mayor Durkin. I think there are people in the city who say governments cannot remake society and solve all these social ills. What a municipal government is supposed to do is fill the potholes, make sure businesses thrive, make sure there's a fair educational system. But you can't remake human nature. What about that?
I think we have to do both. We have to provide essential city services, but we have to do it in a way that advances our deep commitment to equity and our other policy goals. And I think that we've shown that we can do both. I think in the last 4 years, when we've responded to the ordinary kind of challenges and the extraordinary challenges the city might have as a city, the West Seattle Bridge failed. A pier fell into the sound. We had snow events. We had smoke events. Each one of those things, as a city, we were able to rise up and deliver the essential city services we needed to people. And through the pandemic, we did that, and we had to innovate and pivot. And I'll give you an example. We have one of the more remarkable investments in senior services, but most of those services are delivered through our senior centers. When the governor ordered everyone to stay home, all those senior service centers had to close. That meant that those seniors were not only going to lose their opportunity for the classes and the coming together and the socialization. For many of them, it was the only hot meal they had in a day. So overnight, we had to step up a hot meal delivery system for seniors. So we got Lumen Fields kitchens and Fair Start, you know, to provide it. And then we got delivery drivers. So that is a type of city service that shows you can do both and have to do both. You are investing in what is a municipal job, but you're doing it in a way that really addresses equity. The same with our vaccination programs. We saw that COVID-19 did not impact communities equally. Our communities of color had greater impacts both economically and health-wise. And we had to recognize that as we delivered services. So when we set up our vaccinations, we didn't just have Lumen Field, which was a remarkable accomplishment. We made sure we worked with those community-based organizations that had close ties to our communities of color so that our distribution of vaccination would be more equitable and you'd have better health outcomes. So I think it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we, every time we're delivering services at any level of government, we're doing it in a way that recognizes that our commitment to equity and really government has one of the strongest impacts there is on systems. And so if you're going to take systemic racism and dismantle it, you have to build equitable systems in its place.
So what is your confidential advice to your successor, Bruce Harrell, going to be?
You know, I've known Bruce a long time, and we've spent some time since he's been elected. I think Bruce has a lot of challenges ahead of him. We're not done as a city coming out of the pandemic. Omicron is a real threat to us. Recovering our economy is going to be hard because the workplace has changed. And I've said to him and I've said to everyone, he will succeed if we as a city can come together and focus on our common challenges. And that's the hardest job, I think, as mayor, is to be able to pierce those very heated disagreements and find a way for people to have some common discussions. And it was made harder during the pandemic because we literally couldn't get in rooms with people together. Sometimes that was the only way that you could solve a really tough issue. Is maybe you wouldn't get to a point where everyone agreed, but if you got in a room, you could agree on some steps you agreed to. And so I'm really, my hope for Bruce and what I say to all your listeners is, even if you disagree with some of his policies, stay engaged and support him in his success. Because if he is successful, Seattle will be successful. And if Seattle is successful, our region and state will be successful.
Mayor Jenny Durkan, thank you for coming on and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Last year, COVID interrupted a tradition that goes back more than a century, and CBS's Mark Strassman is with the Santa Claus girls as they return to bring cheer to children in need.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
For more than a century, the Santa Claus girls have had West Michigan's longest Christmas list. All these cars, the parents of 6,000 needy children.
Merry Christmas!
That's what it's all about. It's helping the underprivileged children.
This is their only Christmas?
For some.
Yes, it is.
We try our best to give them something that they'll be excited about.
Inside this warehouse, tables stacked with gifts. Five gifts apiece.
Look at that. Isn't that
including
cool?
A handmade hat and mittens. The Santa Claus girls, bringing Christmas to life here since 1908.
The love that the people have for giving back just doesn't go away.
Ask Liz Lemoncusa.
This checkerboard came from Santa Claus girls around 1940.
You're holding your mother's Christmas when she was 10 years old.
I know.
Her mother, Betty Girosh, a Depression baby, died this June at 90.
It just warms my heart to see all these gifts and to know that someone else will have the joy that my mom had when she was younger.
In this line, we found the Carters.
We're doing the best we can right now during this time.
Looking to give their six kids a Christmas.
Without the help, it would be very tiny.
Some people just have a gift for giving.
/7:47, and now from the G and Ursula Show, here he is, G. Scott.
I know he's ready, too, because he's standing rather than sitting. You are poised, my friend.
You know, they're
you're
always
not wrong.
Yeah.
Because this
fire.
Topic that you guys are getting ready to bring up, I'm so on fire. I went to bed about this last night.
Well, see, I figure there's always got to be at least one team that you can compare your team to and be able to say, well, at least we're not doing as bad as they are.
Right.
And that's the Jaguars this year, who are 2-11. And now their head coach, Urban Meyer, is out of a job for what was described as a series of missteps, which is usually a euphemism for something else. So what can you tell us about Urban Meyer?
Well, Urban Meyer was the former head coach of The Ohio State University, where my son is going to school at. And the first red flag for me is when Urban Meyer took the job to become the head coach for the Jacksonville Jaguars, how many people that used to work for him at The Ohio State that was like, nah, I'm just going to stay here.
So he did not bring a posse with him.
Right. Like, that stood out to me. And then, of course, there's all of this stuff that has happened, him not flying back with his team, him being caught at that restaurant on camera with the young lady that was dancing on his lap. Oy. There's all of those different things that were happening. But here's the deal. When there's smoke, there's always fire. And it took, finally, for a former player who, check this out, got paid to play the game to be kicked by Urban Meyer.
He kicked?
Kicked this player. Now, wait a minute, Colleen. He didn't get fired 4 months ago when it was brought up in discussions within the organization. He didn't get fired until, guess when?
When
we found out about it.
Right.
We the people.
Well, because they needed 4 months to figure out if they could bury it.
Right. You know what I mean? Interesting. Right? Now, wait a minute, though,
Colin. Why fire somebody if nobody's going to complain?
But are you ready for the kicker? The Jaguars are 2-11. They've won 2 games and they've lost 11.
Yikes.
Now, let's flip that. Imagine, Dave Ross, if they were 11-2, where they won. We don't even know about this. Because we are living a society that when power and winning go hand in hand, nobody cares about some of these things happening when you win it. Now, one more thing. If this man kicked a player that is getting paid, hold on, ready for this? What do you think he did to players that didn't get paid?
Yeah.
And here's the kicker. You want to know who one of his former players were?
Who?
Aaron Hernandez.
Oh.
You remember the tight end? The Aaron Hernandez that went out and killed people?
Oh, my gosh.
They just say who did it in college? And it was never really brought up. But then when he did it with the Patriots, like, hey, okay, man, look, man, you got to stop killing people, all right? Please, stop.
Now, why are you so fired up about this, considering really the Jaguars have nothing to do with the Seahawks? It's not really our team.
I am fired up because there is this power dynamic in this country that if they say so, it doesn't matter because they have money and influence to say to somebody else saying, hey, you were unfair to me. You did that wrong. And because that person doesn't have power, nobody listens to them. And the only time that people in authority get in trouble is when it is just so obvious.
This goes deep for you.
It's so deep for me. And I'm tired of it. Mm-hmm. And by the way, don't think I'm tired of it because my life is bad. Don't think I'm tired of it because I walk out every day and, oh, gee, are they picking on you? First of all, I will bully a bully. That's number one. Number two, I'm fine.
But I'm sure you've had plenty of people of power talk down to you and you're tired of it. And that's why you want to see suckers like this get taken out.
Absolutely. I remember I had a former boss here when I would come in and do meetings. He would put his feet on the desk. He's a former boss that used to be here.
I remember.
You remember that guy? Yeah. I remember him too. He didn't last
long.
Same
person who put his face to my belly to hear my child.
Oh, yeah. Weirdo. So anyways, this is something that definitely brings emotion out of me because I'm tired of people not being heard. And so finally, you see Urban Meyer. Oh, we fired him because kicking people is not right. What?
But
he kicked them 4 months ago.
Let's be clear about this. So what you're saying is that in today's NFL, if his record was 11-2,
facts,
instead of 2-11,
facts,
he would still have his job,
facts,
despite all the things that you've said.
There would
facts
be a very orchestrated apology, non-apology. Mm-hmm. He would, you know, do some service for, you know, abused children.
But his real mistake was not winning, is what you're saying. That's what his real mistake was here.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know how I know I'm on the right path here? Because I got my main man, Sully, next to me, nodding in agreement.
I see
that. Even Sully's like, yeah. But again, this is pointing a spotlight on where he used to be. And where he used to be was in college football, where head coaches are making $100 million contract.
So do you think there are other shoes to drop here? We're going to find out more now that he no longer has the protection of his high office.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think so. No. I don't think people would risk coming forward being smeared through the media like he's already fired. Get out of here.
Nah.
You think people are going to talk?
Yes.
Okay.
You're right.
Where's he coaching next time in college? They'll probably be hired by next week, right?
Oh, wait a minute. Are you saying that someone like this gets another chance?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's right. I forgot. You know what? You're right. He will get another chance.
Yeah.
Because that's how the game goes, right?
So what I'm saying is that the people who haven't spoken yet, wait till he gets that other job and then start talking.
No, they're going to start speaking now. Even the people who turn a blind eye to his antics before.
Yeah.
Some of those same people are on social media right now. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, he needed to go. Wait, you didn't say that before. See ya.
You heard it here first.
Cleansing breaths, G.
G. Scott comes up at 9 with Ursula Roy team right here on Cairo Radio. You can ring my bell. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. Do you talk baby talk with a loved one, like your spouse? Apparently, there's a reason people do this, and Rachel Bell has looked into the research. First of all, I just need to know, have you ever used baby talk, like with somebody you dated? Or
I hate baby talk.
So, off limits.
Yeah. I like the pet names, but I don't like baby talk. And I was going to say, you actually mispronounced something at the beginning, and I hate to correct you because you're such a seasoned journalist, but it's actually pronounced woof. It's not pronounced love. Yeah, it's pronounced woof.
Woof.
Woof. You know. This is interesting, though. So this article is trying to look into why couples speak baby talk to one another, because the Kinsey Institute, which is, you know, the research in sex, gender, and reproduction. Do you know the Kinsey Institute?
Yes, I do.
Yes. They discovered that 2/3 of all couples that they surveyed speak, quote, romantic baby talk to each other, which I thought was a big number. And they said the chatter is often kept a secret within the couple, which is apparently how I didn't know. So just to clarify, they said, you know, baby talk, of course, is not how babies talk, but it's how adults speak to babies. And in the case of babies, there's actually like a use for it. It's not just an American thing. They found in all cultures, parents and adults speak to babies in a different tone.
Well, it's exaggerated because it captures their attention.
It does. But they said that, quote, it actually triggers the release of neurotransmitters that motivate infants to learn and communicate, which is interesting. I always thought the opposite. I thought, how if we talk to babies like this, why don't they all have a lisp? Like, won't they start talking like that? They're just impersonating us. So the question is, how does this translate to two adults in a relationship who presumably already know how to speak and communicate? So it makes a lot of sense. It's just a way of bonding. You know, it's your own secret language, just like you have that with friends. It's just the same as inside jokes and pet names, and it creates intimacy to have that. It also said, though, that maybe the reason that baby talk, as opposed to inside jokes and nicknames, which don't have to use that obnoxious, gross voice that I hate, also create intimacy. It's like a little bit of an escape from reality and being an adult. So it's like maybe most of our lives we spend together. If you've been married a while, you know, we're doing the taxes and all of these boring things. But when we talk to each other like this.
Nobody talks to each other like that.
Some people do.
Really?
I had a very short-term roommate. We were both moving abroad in 2008. I was moving to Japan. She was moving to France. So we moved in together for 3 months so we could put all our stuff in storage and live in this very creepily bare apartment for a few months before we left. And she was dating someone. And I'd known her for years. But again, it's private. I heard them doing that real gross, just like, honey, are you coming to bed? And I was like, oh my God.
Really?
These people were like corporate superstars and very smart and had this secret gross thing. And they also had a teddy bear that they called a special name. It was so weird.
They went to bed with a stuffed animal too?
Yeah. I've never brought it up to her to this day. Never. Hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like, does your tummy hurt this morning, darling? You know, I suppose you might get away with that. But and nicknames, yeah. And we had some embarrassing nicknames. But
like what?
I'm not going to. I don't share like you do. So I guess I understand the secret language part because, that's a bonding thing. But that kind of baby talk on a regular basis. Yeah.
I do notice, though, sometimes when I'm in a partnership that I use a different tone or voice, but it's not baby talk.
No.
I'll catch myself and I'm like, I don't talk like this to anybody else. I think it is a little higher pitched and maybe a little cutesier. Like, I'm just so cute. This is how I talk.
Maybe I'm doing it without even, you know, by instinct, even realizing. I'll pay attention.
Maybe
now.
This deep voice, radio tone is your baby talk. And at home.
No, I try not to. I try not to use my radio voice at home.
You don't? What do you mean?
Well, you know, like, it's 8:57. Is dinner ready yet? You know.
Oh, your radio voice. Yeah. Okay. No, nobody wants that. I do. I love nicknames, though. I think with most of my friends or like friends from a long ago, I have nicknames. Like I have my friend. We both call each other Schmuppy. I have my poodle. I have my doodle. And other names that also are private and some that are not FCC compliant.
Right, I'm sure.
But I think that it is really bonding and it just is really fun when you have a nickname with someone. So I understand that part.
Okay. Rachel Bell, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, Spill.
Cut it out.
I know. I just
Cut
wanted
it out.
To see what it felt like.
Give us the pet names, Dave.
No.
Well, what about Patty's pet name for you?
Here's what, no.
Please.
No, forget it.
I want to know what to call you when I want to annoy you.
Dave.
Yeah, how
Davey
about that?
Davey Wavy.
Yeah, that would annoy me. Here's the thing I do. I'll tell you this, though, because working in this job, You know, we have conversations, and sometimes she likes to tell long stories.
Oh.
I like to give the wrap-up. You know, I'm looking at my son and say, you know, this segment should be over by now. We have to go to a traffic report.
I hope my husband Chris is listening. It's not just me. He calls, and I'm like, get to the point. Yeah. What's the point?
I know.
You don't have to tell me all the before story. Yeah,
right.
I've
heard this before. What's the news here?
Yes.
Send me something new.
Don't bury the lead. Come on.
Yes.
And that's an occupational hazard. I'll admit that. But I'm trying to get past it.
The patience thing is hard.
Yeah. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.